Dragon in the Sea. Belin's chair rasped on the floor. He got to his feet, went to the side wall at his left, indicated a North Polar projection map.
Ensign Ramsey, we've lost 20 subtugs in these waters over the past 20 weeks, he said.
He turned to Ramsey altogether like a schoolteacher about to propound a problem.
You're familiar with our pressing need for oil.
Familiar? Ramsey restrained a wry smile. Through his mind sped the almost interminable list of regulations on oil conservation. Inspections, issuance forms, special classes, awards for innovations. He nodded. The Admiral's bass rumble continued.
For almost 2 years now, we've been getting extra oil from reservoirs under the marginal seas of the Eastern Powers continental shelf.
His left hand made a vague gesture over the map. Ramsey's eyes widened. Then the rumors were true. The subservices were pirating enemy oil.
We developed an underwater drilling technique working from converted subtugs, said Belin. A high-speed, low-friction pump and a new type of plastic barge complete the general picture.
The Admiral's mouth spread into what he probably imagined as a disarming grin. It succeeded only in making him appear even more piratical.
The boys call the barge a slug, and the pump is a mosquito.
Dutiful chuckles sounded through the room. Ramsey smiled at the forced response, noted that Dr. Oberhausen maintained his reputation as Old Stoneface.
Admiral Belin said, "A slug will carry almost 100 million barrels of oil. The EPs know they're losing oil. They know how, but they can't always be sure of where or when. We're outfoxing them."
The Admiral's voice grew louder.
"Our detection system is superior. Our silencer planes..."
Dr. Oberhausen's brittle voice interrupted him.
"Everything we have is superior except our ability to keep them from sinking us."
The Admiral scowled. Ramsey picked up his cue, entered the breach. "What was the casualty percentage on those 20 subtugs we lost, sir?"
An owl-faced captain near Belin said dryly, "Of the last 20 missions, we lost all 20.
100%,
said Dr. Oberhausen. The sightless eyes seemed to look across the room at a beat-faced lieutenant commander.
"Commander Turner, would you show Mr. Ramsey the gadget your boys found?"
The lieutenant commander pushed a black cylinder about the size of a lead pencil down the table. Hands carried the object along until it reached Ramsey. He studied it.
"Mr. Ramsey's work, of course, involves electronics," said Dr. Oberhausen. "He's a specialist with the instruments used for detecting traumatic memories."
Ramsey caught the cue also. He was the omniscient boo-psych electronics expert, the man who knows your innermost thoughts. Ergo, you don't have innermost thoughts in this man's presence. With an ostentatious gesture, Ramsey put his black box onto the table. He placed the cylinder beside it, managing to convey the impression that he had plumbed the mysteries of the device and found them somehow inferior.
"What the devil is that thing?" he wondered. "You've probably recognized that as a tight-beam broadcaster," said Belin.
Ramsey glanced at the featureless surface of the black cylinder.
"What would these people do if I claimed X-ray vision?" he asked himself.
"Obey must have hypnotized them."
Belin transferred his tone of deference, fear, to Ramsey.
"The EPs have been getting those things aboard our subtugs. We think there's a delayed-action device which turns them on at sea. Unfortunately, we've been unable thus far to dismantle one
without exploding the anti-tamper charge. Ramsey looked at Dr. Oberhausen, back to Belland, implying without words, "Well, if they'd turn these problems over to Busyk." The admiral rallied some of his pride of department, said, "Turner believes he has it solved, however." Ramsey looked at the beat-faced lieutenant commander. "And you'll be a rear-rank swabby if you fail," he thought. The lieutenant commander tried to make himself inconspicuous. The commodore, to Dr. Oberhausen's right, said, "Enemy agents aboard the tugs could be turning them on." Dr. Oberhausen said, "To make a long story short, these devices have been leading the enemy to our secret wells." "The real trouble," said Belland, "is that we're shot through with sleepers. People the EPs planted years ago, long before the war, with orders to wait for the right moment. People in the damnedest places." He scowled. "Why, my driver—" He fell silent, turned the scowl on Ramsey. "We're reasonably certain you're not a sleeper."
"Reasonably certain?" asked Ramsey.
"I am reasonably certain no one in this room is a sleeper," growled Belland. "But that's all I am."
He turned back to the wall map, pointed to a position in the Barents Sea.
"This is the island of Novaya Zemlya. Off the west coast is a narrow shelf. The edge is in about 100 fathoms. It's steep. We've a well into the flank of that shelf, tapping one of the richest oil reservoirs we've ever encountered. The EPs don't even know it's there, yet."
Dr. Oberhausen put a bony hand on the table, tapped a finger once.
"We must make certain Mr. Ramsey understands the morale factor."
He turned towards Ramsey.
"You understand that it has been impossible to keep our losses completely secret. As a result, morale in the sub-tugs has dropped off to almost nothing. We need good news."
Belland said, "Turner, take it from there."
The admiral returned to his chair, lowered himself into it like a battle wagon settling into dry dock. Turner focused watery blue eyes on Ramsey, said,
"We've screened, and re-screened our sub-tug crews. We've found one that looks good. They're at Garden Glen Rest Camp now, and will be coming out in 5 weeks. However, they do not have an electronics officer."
Ramsey thought, "Great grieving Freud, am I going to be palmed off as a submariner?" As though he had read Ramsey's thought, Dr. Oberhausen said,
"That's where you come in, Ramsey."
He nodded to Turner. "Please forgive me, Commander, but we're taking too much time with this." Turner shot a glance at Belland, sank back into his chair.
"Of course, Doctor."
Dr. Oberhausen arose, again with that air of vast assurance.
"This is my field, anyway. You see, Ramsey, the previous electronics officer suffered a psychotic blow-up at the termination of their last mission. It's the same problem you were working on with the men of the Dolphin. Amplified. The sub-tugs are smaller, a complement of only 4 men. The focal symptoms point to a kind of induced paranoia."
"The captain?" asked Ramsey.
"Precisely," said Dr. Oberhausen. "We are now impressing the natives with our mysterious knowledge," thought Ramsey.
He said, "I noticed similar conditions in the battle fatigue syndrome when I was on the Dolphin." He patted the box in front of him. The captain's emotional variations were reflected in varying degrees all through the ship's personnel.
"Dr. Oberhausen outlined your work with the men of the Dolphin," said Turner.
Ramsey nodded. "I'm troubled by one point here. You say this crew rates high. That doesn't check if the captain is a borderline psychotic."
"Again, that's where you come in," said Dr. Oberhausen.
We were about to beach this captain, but now Battle Comp tells us he and his crew have far and away the highest chance of success in this mission to Novaya Zemlya, but only if certain other conditions are present.
He paused, tugged at an earlobe. Ramsey caught the signal, thought, ah, there's the bite. Somebody important hasn't agreed to this arrangement, and it's vital to obey that I get on that sub-tug crew. Who are we playing to? The Admiral? No, he'd go himself if Obey said the word.
Ramsey's eyes abruptly caught the scowling glare of the Commodore on Dr. Oberhausen's left, and at the same moment he noted for the first time the tiny sunburst on the Commodore's collar.
A presidential aide. That would be the one.
One of the other conditions would be that they have secret psychological monitoring, said Ramsey. How had you planned to link in my remote-control vampire gauge to his pivotal captain without his knowing?
An ingenious solution has been proposed by Admiral Belland, said Dr. Oberhausen. Security has a new type of detector to combat those spy beam transmitters. A speaker pellet is surgically embedded in the neck and tuned to wave scanners which are similarly embedded beneath the armpits. Micro-instrumentation would permit us to include with the speaker the recorders you need.
Ramsey nodded toward the Admiral. Clever! You'd rig this sub-tug skipper that way, send me along to keep him in balance.
Yes, said Dr. Oberhausen. However, there has been some objection raised.
The sightless eyes seemed to peer down at the Commodore on his left.
On the grounds that you have no extended deep-tug combat experience, it's a specialized service.
The Commodore grunted, glared at Ramsey.
We've been at war 16 years, he said. How is it you've escaped combat?
Old school tie, thought Ramsey.
He turned his telemeter box until one flat surface faced the Commodore, squinted at the officer over it.
When in doubt, fire a broadside.
Every man we preserve for combat brings victory that much nearer, said Ramsey. The Commodore's leathery face grew dark.
Mr. Ramsey has a special combination of training, psychology and electronics, which have made him too valuable to risk, said Dr. Oberhausen. He has made only the most essential cruises, such as that with the Dolphin, when that was absolutely required.
If he's so valuable, why are we risking him now? Demanded the Commodore.
This all seems highly irregular.
Admiral Belland sighed, stared at the Commodore.
The truth is, Lewis, this new emotional telemetering equipment which Mr. Ramsey developed can be used by others. However, his inventive talents are the very things which make his services so essential at this time. You may think me rude, said the Commodore. But I'd like to know also why this young man, if he's as good as all that, is still...
He flicked a glance at Ramsey's collar bars.
An ensign.
Dr. Oberhausen held up a hand, said,
Permit me, my dear Admiral.
He turned to the Commodore.
It is because there are people who resent the fact that I have been able to keep myself and my top department heads out of uniform. There are those who do not see the necessity for this essential separation. It is regrettable, therefore, that those of my people in the lower echelons who are required to wear uniforms sometimes find it difficult to gain advancement, no matter how talented they may be.
The Commodore looked as though he were about to explode.
By rights, said Dr. Oberhausen, Mr. Ramsey should at least be a Commodore.
Several fits of coughing broke out simultaneously around the table. Ramsey suddenly wished he were anywhere else but under the eyes of this Commodore. The latter said, "Very well, my objection is withdrawn." The tone of voice said, "I will pass sentence in my own court."
"I have planned," said Dr. Oberhausen, "upon completion of this mission, to have Mr. Ramsey released from the service and installed as head of a new department devoted to problems of submariners."
A harsh smile pulled at the corners of the Commodore's mouth. "If he lives through it," he said. Ramsey swallowed. As though he had not heard, Dr. Oberhausen said,
"The training will be a problem. That we have 5 weeks plus the full facilities of Busike."
Belland heaved his bulk from the chair, stepped to one side.
"If there are no more questions, gentlemen, I believe we are all satisfied with Mr. Ramsey."
He glanced at his wristwatch.
"The medics are waiting for him now, and he's going to need every minute of the next 5 weeks."
Ramsey got to his feet, took the telemeter box under his arm, a question in his eyes.
"You're also going to be rigged as a walking detection system," said Belland.
Dr. Oberhausen appeared to materialize beside Ramsey.
"If you'll come with me, please, John."
He took Ramsey's arm.
"I've had the essential material about Commander Sparrow. He's the captain of this sub-tug, and the other two crewmen reduced to absolute minimum. We've set aside a special ward at the Bureau for you. You're going to be our prize patient for—"
Ramsey heard Turner speaking behind him.
"Dr. Oberhausen called the ensign John. Is he the Long John Ramsey who—"
The rest was blurred as Dr. Oberhausen raised his voice.
"It's going to be rough on you, John."
They stepped into the outer corridor.
"Your wife has been notified."
Dr. Oberhausen lowered his voice.
"You handled yourself very well in there."
Ramsey suddenly realized that he was allowing himself to be guided by a blind man. He laughed, found that he had to explain the laughter.
"It was the way you handled that brassy Commodore," he said. "You don't lie at all well," said Dr. Oberhausen. "But I'll let it pass. Now, about the Commodore. He's a member of the board which passes upon promotions for Busike men."
Ensign Ramsey abruptly found that laughter had left him. Ramsey often referred to his 5 weeks' training for the sub-tug mission as the time I lost 20 pounds. They gave him 3 rooms in the sound wing of Unadilla Naval Hospital. Blank, white enclosures, furnished in rattan and cigarette-scarred mahogany. A functional TV set, equally functional hospital bed on high legs. 1 room was set up for training. Hypnophone, wall diagrams, mock-ups, tapes, films. His wife, Janet, a blonde nurse, received a weekend schedule for visits, Saturday nights and Sundays. Their children, John Jr., age 2, and Peggy, age 4, were not permitted in the hospital, had to be packed off to their grandmother's at Fort Linton, Mississippi. Janet, wearing a one-piece red dress, came storming into the sitting room of Ramsey's suite on their first Saturday night. She kissed him, said,
"I knew it!"
"Knew what?"
"That sooner or later, the Navy and that awful Obey would be regulating our sex life."
Ramsey, aware that everything he said and did in the hospital was being monitored, tried to shush her.
"Oh, I know they're listening," she said.
She threw herself onto the rattan couch, crossed her legs, lighted a cigarette, which she puffed furiously.
"That Obey gives me the creeping creeps," she said.
"That's because you let him," said Ramsey.
"And because that's the effect he wants to give," she countered.
"Well, yes," admitted Ramsey. Janet jumped to her feet, threw herself into his arms.
"Oh, I'm being a fool.
They said I wasn't to upset you.
He kissed her, rumpled her hair.
I'm not upset.
I told them I couldn't upset you if I tried.
She pushed away from him.
Darling, what is it this time?
Something dangerous? It isn't another one of those horrible submarines.
I'm going to be working with some oil men, he said. She smiled.
Oh, that doesn't sound bad at all.
Will you be drilling a well?
The well's already drilled, he said. We're going to see about increasing production. Janet kissed his chin.
Old efficiency expert.
Let's go to dinner, he said. How are the kids? They went out, arm in arm, chatting about the children.
Ramsey's weekday routine began at 0500 hours when the nurse entered with his wake-up shot to rouse him from the hypnophone drugs. High-protein breakfast, more shots, blood test.
This is going to hurt a little.
Oh, ouch! What do you mean a little? Next time, warn me.
Don't be a big baby.
Diagrams, floor plans of Hell Driver class subtugs. They turned him over to a large subtug expert from security, Clinton Reed. Bald as an egg, thin eyes, thin nose, thin mouth, thick skin. Sense of duty as solid as his neck. Absolutely no sense of humor.
This is important, Ramsey. You have to be able to go anywhere on this vessel. Man, any control, blindfolded.
We'll have a mock-up for you in a couple of days, but first you have to get a picture of it in your mind. Try flashing these plans, and then we'll test your memory.
Okay, I've finished the general layout.
Try me.
Where's the pile room?
Ask me something hard.
Answer the question.
Oh, all right. It's forward in the bulb nose, first 32 feet.
Why?
Because of the teardrop shape of this class and for balance. The nose gives the most room for shielding.
How thick is the radiation wall behind the pile room?
I missed that.
12 feet. Remember it? 12 feet.
Well, I can tell you what it's made of.
Hafnium, lead, graphite, and porusene. What's on the aft face of the radiation wall?
Direct reading gauges for the reactor. Repeaters are in the control room, forward bulkhead to the right of the first-level catwalk. Then there are lockers for 9BG suits, tool lockers, doors to the tunnels leading into the pile room.
You're getting it.
How many tunnels into the pile room?
4. 2 top, 2 bottom. Not to be entered for more than 12 minutes at a time unless wearing an ABG suit.
Fine. What's the rated horsepower?
273,000, reduced to about 260,000 by the silencer planes behind the screw.
Excellent.
How long is the engine room?
Nope. That one's gone, too.
Look, Ramsey, these are important. You have to remember these distances. You have to get a feeling for them.
What if you don't have any lights?
Okay. How long is the damn thing?
22 feet.
It fills the whole midship section.
The 4 electric engines are set 2 to a level with the gearbox for the drive below center aft.
Gotcha. Here, let me take a flash of the aft section.
Okay. Now try me.
How many catwalks in the engine room and where located?
Look, I just flashed the aft section.
How many catwalks and... Okay, let's see. 1 center of the control desk going forward, 1 off-center into machine stores on the second level below, 1 called A-level into top stores. Same for bottom level, called B-level. Short bridging catwalks from A and B levels to the engines and oxy tanks. And 1 very short to the conning tower retracted, which lifts into a section of steps when the tower is extended.
Good. You see, you can do this if you set your mind to it. Now, tell me how the 4 staterooms are placed.
Staterooms yet.
Stop dodging the question.
Wise guy. Let's see. Captain is top level starboard behind the electronics shack. First officer port side behind the recreation room sick bay.
Engineering officer starboard below the captain's quarters and behind the machine shop.
Electronics officer port side below the first officer and aft of galley stores. That's the place for me. Gonna cut me a private door into galley stores.
Where's the galley?
That one I can't answer. It's farport, top level, entered through the wardroom. Selector controls for the prepackaged meals are against the bulkhead separating galley and wardroom. The galley wardroom unit is between control deck and rec room. What's behind the staterooms? Machinery of the Palmer induction drive.
Why an induction drive?
Because at the dive limit for hell divers, there can be no weak points in the hull, therefore no shaft through the hull.
You're getting the drive on the hypnophone tonight.
Every man blindfolded. There'll be a model for you to work on day after tomorrow.
Oh, goody.
What's the pressure hull limit for hell divers?
3,010 pounds to the square inch or 7,000 feet.
Stick to your first answer. Pressure varies with different water conditions. You'd be okay at 7,100 feet in one place, dead at 6,900 another. Learn to depend on your static pressure gauge. Now, let's go to the atmosphere composition. What's a vampire gauge?
A little device worn on your wrist during deep dives. Needle goes into your vein. Tells you if your CO2 diffusion is fast enough so you won't crock out. It also tattles on nitrogen.
What's minimum diffusion?
When you get below 0.200 on CO2, you get the GBs. If your blood CO2 count goes to 4%, you're in trouble. With nitrogen, it's different. The sub-tug atmosphere is supposed to be entirely cleared of it. A small quantity of helium is substituted.
How do you get by with the high atmospheric pressure?
Aerobic, carbonic, anhydrase is fed into the atmosphere by the ventilator system. This speeds up the CO2, loading and unloading of the blood, prevents gas bubbles forming.
You're good on that. Did you know it before?
My emotional telemeter is just a glorified vampire gauge.
Oh, sure. Now, why is the electronics officer so important?
Contact with the exterior control motors is by coded wave pulse. If the E-system breaks down when a sub-tug is submerged, it stays submerged.
Right. Now, let's go through the plans again.
Not again. Start with the reactor room in detail.
Slave driver.
The nightly hypnophone sessions flooded Ramsey's mind with the new knowledge. Pressure hull, resonating hull, tank hull, pressure compensating system, header box, reactor controls, search and sounding, diving plane controls, valve controls, pile checkoff, sonar ran automatic navigation board, atmosphere controls, automatic time log Mark 9, gyro controls, tow controls, plastic barge, oil, components of needle torpedoes, external racking system, torpedo homing systems, scrambler systems, 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 systems. There were times when Ramsey's head felt filled to the bursting point. Dr. Oberhausen appeared in Ramsey's quarters on the fourth day of training. The doctor's unpressed clothes gave him the appearance of a bedraggled robin. He came in quietly, sat down beside Ramsey, who was seated in a viewer scope sequence training hookup. Ramsey pulled the fitted faceplate away from his eyes, turned to Dr. Oberhausen.
Ah, the chief of the Inquisition.
You are comfortable, Johnny?
The sightless eyes seemed to stare through him. No.
Good. You are not supposed to be comfortable.
The doctor's chair creaked as he shifted his weight. I have come about the man Garcia, who is engineering officer of this crew.
What's wrong with him? Qualifications? Navigator, superior. Gunnery officer, superior. Medical officer, advanced first aid and pressure syndrome, excellent. General submarine competence, superior.
Ramsey turned to the other folder. Lieutenant Commander Leslie Nunn Bonnet. Age 38. Picture of a heavy-bodied man just under 6 feet, with brown, wavy hair. Artificial wave? Aquiline nose, overhanging eyebrows, the look of a brooding hawk. Orphan foundling, raised at Cape Neston home for the unwanted.
For the unwanted, thought Ramsey.
Married 4 times, 2 children, 1 by each of first 2 wives. Maintains marriage relationship with wife number 4, Helene Davis Bonnet, age 29, Miss Georgia of 2021.
The unwanted, thought Ramsey. He's carrying out an unconscious revenge pattern against women, getting even with the mother who deserted him.
Qualifications? Navigator? Good. Supply officer? Excellent. Gunnery officer? Superior. Top torpedo officer of sub-tugs 4 years running. General submarine competence? Excellent. Plus.
Ramsey looked at the note in the psych record. Held from advancement to his own command by imperfect adjustment to deep-seated insecurity feelings.
Wrong? Have I said anything was wrong?
Ramsey completely disengaged the viewerscope, sat back.
Come to the point. God, the impatience of youth!
Dr. Oberhausen sighed.
Do you have a file on Garcia?
You know I have.
Get it, please, and read me what you have.
Ramsey leaned to his right, took a file folder from the bottom ledge of his coffee table, opened it. Garcia's picture on the inside front cover showed a short man, about 5 feet 7 inches, slim, Latin features, dark, black curly hair, sardonic half-smile. The picture managed to impart a sense of devil-may-care. Under the photograph, a note in Ramsey's handwriting.
Member Easton Championship Water Polo Team likes handball. Read to me, said Dr. Oberhausen.
Ramsey turned the page, said,
839 came up from ranks, ex-CPO machinist, ham radio license, born Puerto Madryn, Argentina, father cattle rancher, Jose Pedro Garcia y Aguinaldo, mother died at birth of daughter when Garcia aged 3, religion, Catholic, wears rosary around neck, takes blessing of priest before each mission, wife, Beatrice, age 31.
Do you have her picture?
Asked Dr. Oberhausen. No.
A pity. I am told she is quite beautiful. Continue, please.
Ramsey said. Educated at New Oxford. That accounts for his British accent.
I grieved when the British Isles were destroyed, said Dr. Oberhausen. Such a lovely culture, really. So basically solid, immovable. But that is weakness also. Continue, if you please.
Plays bagpipes, said Ramsey. He looked at the doctor.
Now there's something.
A Latin American playing the bagpipes.
I see nothing wrong with that, Johnny. For certain moods, nothing is more soothing.
Ramsey raised his gaze to the ceiling.
Soothing!
He looked back at the Busite chief. Why am I reading this?
I wanted to get the full flavor of Garcia in mind before imparting the latest morsel from security.
Which is?
That Garcia may be one of these sleepers who are giving security so many sleepless nights.
Ramsey snorted.
Garcia? That's insane, as well as suspect me. They are still investigating you, said Dr. Oberhausen. As to Garcia, perhaps, perhaps not. Counterintelligence has turned up the description of a sleeper supposed to be in the sub-tugs. The description fits Garcia. Security almost called off the mission. I convinced them to go ahead by suggesting that you be primed to watch Garcia.
Ramsey returned to the color photograph in his file folder, observed the sardonic smile.
I say we're chasing shadows, and that may be what the EEPs really want. If it's carried to its illogical extreme, certain security thinking is first cousin to paranoia.
Dementia praecox type.
Dr. Oberhausen lifted himself from the rattan chair. It gave off a reedy creaking.
Do not say that to the security gentlemen when they come to brief you on Garcia, he said. Oh, and one other thing. The Commodore is sharpening knives with which to carve you, if there is some error on this mission.
I have you to thank for that, said Ramsey.
I take care of my own, said Dr. Oberhausen. Fear not on that score.
He waved toward the viewer scope.
Continue with your studies. I have other work.
Ramsey waited for the door to close, threw the file folder back onto the coffee table, took 20 deep breaths to calm his nerves. Presently, he leaned to the right, captured the folders on the other two crew members, scanned them. Commander Harvey Acton Sparrow. Age 41, picture of a tall, thin man with balding, sandy hair, a face of sharp planes, stooped shoulders.
He looks like a small-town college professor, thought Ramsey.
How much of that is conditioned on his early desire to teach mathematics? Does he resent the fact that his hard-crust Navy family forced him to follow in the old man's footsteps? Father, Rear Admiral Acton Orwell Sparrow, lost with sub-cruiser Plunger in Battle of Irish Sea. 16 October 2018. Mother, Janine Kobe Sparrow. Invalid. Heart. Lives at Waters Point Government Rest Home. Wife, Rita, age 36. Blonde. Childless.
Does Sparrow know that his wife is unfaithful? Ramsey asked himself. Most of their friends are aware of it.
The unwanted, he thought. Burnett probably doesn't want advancement. This way his commander supplies the father authority lacking in his youth. Ramsey tossed the folder back onto the coffee table, leaned back to think. An association of twisted and tangled threads. Sparrow and Burnett were Protestants, Garcia a Catholic. No evidence of religious friction. These men have evolved a tight working arrangement. Witness the fact that their sub-tug has the highest efficiency rating in the service. What has been the effect of losing Heppner, the other electronics officer? Will they resent his replacement? Damn. Heppner was the wrong one to go. A case history with no apparent clues. Quiet childhood, calm home life. Two sour notes, a broken love affair at age 32. It should have been someone like Burnett, the unwanted. Or Captain Sparrow, the frustrated mathematician.
Sleeping?
It was Reed, the constant tutor.
It's 3 o'clock, he said. I brought a layout plan of the electronic shack on these hell divers.
He handed a blueprint to Ramsey, pointed as he spoke.
Bench here, vise here, wrench kit, micro-lathe, vacuum pumps, test board plugs.
Okay, I can read.
You have to be able to plug into that test board in total darkness, said Reed.
He sat down squarely in the rattan chair lately occupied by Dr. Oberhausen.
Tomorrow you're going to start training on a mock-up.
Tomorrow's Saturday, Clint,
Ramsey glared at him. You don't get out of here before 1800 hours, said Reed. He bent forward over the plan.
Now, concentrate on that plug layout. This here is emergency lighting. You'll be expected to find it the first time.
What if it takes me 2 tries?
Reed leaned back, turned his flinty gaze on Ramsey. "Mr. Ramsey, there's something you should understand so thoroughly that it's second nature to you."
"Yeah, what's that?"
"There is no such thing as a minor accident on a submarine."
Commander Sparrow trotted down the ramp from the tube landing, slowed as he stepped into the cavernous, floodlighted gloom of the underground submarine moorage. A fine mist of condensation from the rock ceiling far away in upper blackness beat against his face. He picked his way through the pattern of scurrying jitneys, darting, intent people. Ahead of him, the bulbous whale mound of his sub-tug rose above the pier. 140-foot Bognerian diva, center stage, beneath banks of floodlights. Instructions from the final security session jangled through his mind.
"Your crew has the top security rating of the service, but you must remain alert for sleepers."
"In my crew? Hell, man, I've known them all for years. Bennett's been with me 8 years. Joe Garcia and I served together before the war. Heppner and..."
His face had crimsoned.
"What about the new E officer?"
"You won't need to worry about him. Now, the inspectors assure us there are no enemy signal devices aboard your boat."
"Then why this gadget in my neck?"
"That's just an added precaution."
"What about this new man? What's his E rating?"
"He's one of the best in the service. Here, look at his record."
"Limited combat experience in Gulf Patrol."
"He's practically a dryback." "But look at his E rating."
"Limited combat."
A jitney driver shouted at Sparrow, bringing him out of his reverie. He glanced at his wristwatch. 07:38. 22 minutes until cast off. His stomach tightened. He quickened his steps.
"Damn security's last-minute details."
Across the ebony velvet of the mooring pool, he could see the glow tubes outlining the marine tunnel. Down the 160-mile slant of that tunnel, out into the underwater deeps of DeSoto Canyon and the Gulf of Mexico, and beyond, ranged the enemy. An enemy grown suddenly, terrifyingly, 100% effective against vessels such as his. It came to Sparrow that the marine tunnel formed a grotesque birth canal. This cavern, carved under a Georgia mountain, was nestled in the earth like a fantastic womb. When they took their vessel out to do battle, they were born into a terrible world that they did not want. He wondered what Boovsyke would think of an idea like that. They'd probably rate it as an indication of weakness, he thought. But why shouldn't I have weakness? Something about fighting a war 1.5 miles under the ocean, the unrelenting pressure of water all around, exposes every weakness in a man. It's the pressures. Constant pressures. 4 men, isolated in pressure, held in a plasteel prison, as they are held in the prisons of their souls. Another jitney scurried across Sparrow's path. He dodged, looked up at his boat. He was close enough now to make out the nameplate on the retractable conning tower high above him. Feeney and Ram, S-1881. The boarding ramp swooped down from the tower in a long, graceful curve. The dock captain, a moon-faced lieutenant commander in fatigues, hurried up to Sparrow, a checklist in his hands.
"Captain Sparrow?"
Sparrow turned without stopping.
"Yes?" "Oh, hello, Myers. Are all the ready crews off?"
Myers fell into step beside him.
"Most of them. You've lost weight, Sparrow."
"Touch of dysentery," said Sparrow. "Got some bad fruit up at Garden Glen."
"Has my new electronics officer showed up?"
"Haven't seen him. His gear came along earlier." "Funny thing. There was a sealed box with his stuff. About so by so."
He gestured with his hands.
"Cleared by Admiral Bellin."
"Comsec?"
"None other."
"Why was it sealed?"
It's supposed to contain some highly delicate instruments to monitor your new long-range search equipment. It was sealed so no zealous searcher could foul the works.
Oh, I take it the new long-range gear is installed.
Yes, you're battle-checking it.
Sparrow nodded. A cluster of men at the foot of the boarding ramp snapped to attention as the two officers approached.
Sparrow and Myers stopped. Sparrow said, "At ease."
Myers said, 16 minutes, Captain." He held out his hand, shook with Sparrow.
"Good luck. Give 'em hell."
"Right," said Sparrow.
Myers headed for the foot of the dock. Sparrow turned toward a heavy-bodied, hawk-faced man beside the ramp, First Officer Bennett.
"Hi, Liz."
"Good to see you, Skipper," said Bennett.
He tucked a clipboard under his left arm, dismissed three ratings who were with him, turned back to Sparrow.
"Where'd you and Rita go after the party?"
"Home,"
said Sparrow.
"So'd we," said Bennett.
He hooked a thumb toward the submarine behind him.
"Final safety inspection's completed, spare gear checked out, but there's a bit of a delay. Heppner's replacement hasn't reported."
Sparrow cursed inwardly, felt a stomach-gripping surge of frustration, anger.
"Where is he?"
Bennett shrugged.
"All I know is that security called and said there might be some delay. I told them..."
"Security?"
"That's right." "Suffering Jesus!" barked Sparrow. "They always have to wait until the last minute. They had me..."
He broke off. That was classified.
"They said they'd do their best," said Bennett.
Sparrow pictured the complicated arrangements which would pass the Fenian ram through their own defense network, outward bound.
"It could take another day to set up a new passage time."
Bennett glanced at his wristwatch, took a deep breath.
"I told them 0800 was the latest. They wouldn't answer a damned one of my,
He fell silent as the ramp beside them rattled to descending footsteps. Both men looked up, saw three figures coming down. Two ratings, carrying heavy-duty electronics detection gear, followed by a short, wiry man with dark Latin features. He wore stained service fatigues, carried a small electronic search box under his right arm.
"Don Jose Garcia," said Sparrow.
Garcia shifted the search box to his left arm, stepped down to the dockside.
"Skipper, am I glad to see you?"
Sparrow moved back to permit the ratings to pass with their load, looked questioningly at the search box under Garcia's arm. Garcia shook his head.
"For God and country," he said. "But sometimes I think I overdraw my account with God."
He crossed himself.
"The security chaps have had us at this floating sewer pipe half the night. We've been over it from stem to stern 4 distinct times, not a blip. Now, I say to you, they want me to make another search after we get underway down tunnel."
He raised his eyebrows.
"I ask you."
"Well, we'll have to do it," said Sparrow. "I've allowed time before our first contact point for total deep-dive inspection."
"I say,"
said Garcia. He grinned.
"You know, I've already gone and rigged for it."
Sparrow answered the grin, felt some of the tensions inside him begin to unknot. Bennett glanced significantly at his watch.
12 min.
The whine of a command jitney's electric motor intruded upon him. All three men turned toward the sound. It came down the dark line of mooring slots, its single light casting an erratic cyclops gleam upon the damp concrete. The jitney swerved up to the ramp, jerked to a stop. A red-headed man with a round, innocent face sat beside the driver, clutching his uniform cap in his hands. Sparrow saw ensign's bars on the man's collar, thought, "That will be my new E officer." Sparrow grinned at the man's obvious relief upon a safe arrival. The recklessness of the base jitney drivers was a standard service joke. The new man put his cap over his red hair, stepped out of the jitney. The machine rebounded from his weight. The driver whirled the jitney back the way they had come.
The ensign stepped up to Sparrow, saluted, said, "I'm Ramsay." Sparrow returned the salute, said,
"Glad to have you aboard."
Ramsay handed his service record to Sparrow, said, "No time to send these through channels." Sparrow passed the papers to Bonnet, said,
"This is Mr. Bonnet, first officer."
He turned to Garcia.
"Mr. Garcia, engineer."
"Good to meet you," said Ramsay.
"We'll soon dissuade you of that illusion," said Garcia.
Sparrow smiled, offered his hand to Ramsay, was surprised to feel strong muscle in the new man's grip. The fellow just looked soft. Bonnet and Garcia also shook hands. Ramsay was busy cataloguing his first visual impressions of the three men in the flesh. It seemed strange to be meeting these people for the first time, when he felt that he already knew them. And that, he knew, would have to be concealed. Odd bits of knowledge about the personal lives of these men, even the names of their wives, could not be in the memory of a new man.
"Security said you might be delayed," said Sparrow.
"What's got security on its ear?" asked Ramsay. "I thought they were going to dissect me."
"We'll discuss that later," said Sparrow.
He rubbed at the thin scar on his neck where the security surgeons had embedded the detection system speaker.
"Cast off is 0800. Mr. Garcia will take you aboard. Get into fatigues. You'll be assisting him in a final spy beam inspection as we get underway."
"Yes, sir," said Ramsay.
"Your gear came along hours ago,"
said Garcia. He took Ramsay's arm, propelled him toward the ramp.
"Let's get with it."
They hurried up the ramp. Ramsay wondered when he could break away to examine his telemeter box. He felt an anxiety, a need to study the first records on Sparrow. "That mannerism of rubbing his neck," thought Ramsay. "Extreme nervous tension, well concealed, but it shows in the tight movements." On the pier, Sparrow turned to look across the mooring basin at a string of moving lights.
"Here comes our tow, Les."
"Do you think we'll make it, Skipper?"
"We always have."
"Yes, but
for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed," said Sparrow. "The night is far spent. The day is at hand. Let us, therefore, cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light."
He looked at Bonnet.
"Paul wrote that to the Romans 2,000 years ago."
"A pretty wise fellow," said Bonnet. A bosun's whistle sounded at the head of the dock. A swifty crane came darting up to take away the boarding ramp. Ratings hurried to attach the hooks, looked inquiringly at the two officers. Men hurried along the pier, a new purposefulness in their movements. Sparrow swept his gaze over the scene.
"We're being asked to perform," he said.
He gestured for Bonnet to precede him up the ramp.
"Like the man said, let's get with it."
They climbed to the conning tower. Bonnet ducked for the cable rack, which mounted the float for their TV periscope. As a matter of routine, he glanced at the housing, saw that it was secured for dive. He grasped the ladder arms, slid down into the sub-tug. Sparrow remained topside. Around him, the mooring basin appeared a vast lake. He looked at the rock ceiling's blackness.
"There should be stars," he thought. "Men should get one last look at stars before they go under the sea."
On the pier below, scurrying figures moved to cast off the magnetic grapples. For a moment, Sparrow felt like a useless pawn being thrown into a sacrifice position. There had been a time, he knew, when captains conned their vessels away from the dock, shouting orders through a megaphone. Now it was all automatic, done by machines and by men who were like machines. A surface tug swung up to their bow, slapped its tow grapples onto them. White water boiled from beneath the tug's stern. The Fenian ram resisted momentarily, as though reluctant to leave, then began a slow, ponderous movement. out into the basin. They cleared the slot, and another tug slid alongside their stern. The Magna Shoe men leaped onto the ram silencer planes, hitched the tow and guide cables of the long plastic tube which stretched out across the dark water of the basin. Their shouts came up to Sparrow in the tower like the clear noise of children. He tasted a sudden, oil-tainted breeze and knew they had crossed the path of a ventilator duct. No special fanfare, no brass bands, no ceremony for the departure of a raider, he thought. We are as a reed shaken with the wind. And what go we out into the wilderness to see? No John the Baptist awaits us. But it's a kind of baptism all the same. Somewhere in the darkness, a klaxon hooted. Turn and identify the man next to you. Another security scheme. Show your identification when the horn sounds. Damn security. Out here I identify myself to my God and none other. Sparrow looked astern at the set of the tow. Oil. War demanded the pure substance born in the sediment of rising continent. Vegetable oil wouldn't do. War was no vegetarian. War was a carnivore. The tow tug shifted to the side of the ram, and now the sub was being nosed into the traveler rack, which would carry it down to the underwater canyon and the gulf. Sparrow looked at the control console in the conning tower and the green clear-away light. He flashed the standby signal to the tug below him and, with a practiced motion, touched the controls to retract the tower. It slid smoothly into the sub, its plasteel lid twisted into the groove seats. A chest microphone hung beside the tower console. Sparrow slipped it on, spoke into it. "Rig for dive!" He focused his attention on the dive board in front of him. Back came Bonnet's voice, robbed of life by the metallic mutes of the intercom.
"Pressure in the hull?"
One by one, the lights on Sparrow's dive board shifted from red to green. "Green board," he said. "Stand by." Now he could feel the hull pressure and another pressure in his stomach. He closed the signal circuit which told the outside crews that the sub-tug was ready to go down tunnel. The ram shifted, lurched. A dull clang resonated through the boat. Across the top of the dive board, amber lights flashed. They were in the grip of the tunnel elevator. 20 hours of free ride. Sparrow grasped the handhold beside the dive board, swung down and out onto the engine room catwalk. His feet made a slithering sound on the catwalk padding as he made his way aft, crawled through the control room door, dogged it behind him. His gaze paused for a moment on the hand-etched brass plate Heppner had attached beside the door, a quotation from some 19th-century pundit. "No one but a crazy man would waste his time inventing a submarine, and no one but a lunatic would go down in it. If it were invented." Through the gulf shelf in the Florida elbow, DeSoto Canyon slashes the soft peninsula limestone like a railroad cut. 14 fathoms where it starts in Apalachee Bay, more than 260 fathoms where it dives off into the ocean deeps south of Cape San Blas and east of Tampa. The gulf exit of the marine tunnel opens into the canyon wall at 50 fathoms, a twilight world of waving fan kelp, red fingers of Gorgonian coral, flashing sparkles of reef-dwelling fish. The Fenian ram coasted out of the dark hole of the tunnel like a sea monster emerging from its lair, turned, scattering the fish, and slanted down to a resting place in the burnt umber mud of the canyon bottom. A sonar pulse swept through the boat. Detectors in the triple hulls responded, registered on control gauges of the navigation deck. Garcia's clipped accent, oddly squeaking in the oxygen-high atmosphere, repeated the checklist
as he watched the Christmas tree lights of the main board.
No leaks. Trim weights balanced. External salvage air clear and pressure holding. Atmosphere free of nitrogen. TV eyes clear and seeing. TV periscope surfaced and seeing. Periscope gyro checks with...
His laughter echoed through the intercom.
Seagull! It tried to land on the peri box as I started to reel in, lit on its fanny in the water.
Burnett's crisp tones interrupted.
What's it like topside, Joe? Clear. Just daybreak. Going to be a good day for fishing.
Sparrow's voice rasped over the speakers.
Enough of that. Was there anyone up there to spot the gull's flop?
They could have seen our box.
Negative, Skipper.
Sparrow said, Les, give me the complete atmosphere check. Vampire gauges everyone. Follow the check. Report any deviations. The patient inspection continued. Ramsey interrupted.
I'm in the induction drive chamber. A lot of static here as I entered.
Garcia said,
Did he go back by the lower south tunnel?
Lower?
I noticed that myself earlier. We'll rig a ground for the scuff mat. I think that'll fix it.
I grounded myself before entering,
Sparrow said. Run that down, Joe. Les, where are you?
Second level catwalk in the engine room.
Relieve Joe on the main board. Ramsey, get into your shack. Contact with base in 11 minutes.
Aye, Skipper.
Sparrow moved from his position on the control deck below Garcia to a point in the first-level door which was open to permit visual inspection of the big gauges forward on the radiation wall.
That room in the bow, he thought. That's what worries me. We can see into it with our TV eyes. Gauges tell us what's happening, but we can't touch it with our bare hands. We don't have a real feeling for that place.
He mopped his forehead with a large red handkerchief.
Something somewhere is wrong.
He was a sub-tug skipper who had learned to depend on his feeling for the boat. A string of Spanish curses in Garcia's voice, rendered metallic by the intercom, interrupted his reverie. Sparrow barked,
Joe, what's wrong?
He turned toward the stern, as though to peer through the bulkheads.
Wipe a rag in the rotor system. It was rubbing the induction ring every revolution. That's Ramsey's static.
Does it look deliberate?
Did you ever come across a silk wiping rag?
The sound of a grunt came over the intercom.
There, by heaven!
Sparrow said,
Save that rag!
Then,
Ramsey, where are you?
In the shack, warming up the transmitter.
Did you hear Joe?
Yes.
Tell base about that rag. Tell them,
Skipper!
It was Garcia's voice.
There's oil in the atmosphere back here.
Sparrow said, A mist of oil plus static spark equals an explosion. Where's that oil coming from?
Just a minute.
A clanking of metal against metal.
Open petcock in the lube system. Just a crack. Enough to squirt a fine spray under full drive.
Sparrow said,
Ramsey, include that in the report to base.
Hi, Skipper.
Joe, I'm coming back there, said Sparrow. We're going over that drive room with a microscope.
I've already started.
Burnett said,
Skipper, would you send Ramsey up here after he gets off the contact? I'll need help checking the main board. Hear that, Ramsey?
Asked Sparrow.
Aye.
Comply.
Will do.
Sparrow went aft, dropped down to the lower level, crawled through the shaft tunnel and into the drive room. A cone-shaped space dominated by the gleaming brass induction ring, the spaced coils. He could smell the oil, a heavy odor. Garcia was leaning into the coil space, examining the induction ring by magnifying glass.
They're just little things, said Sparrow, but taken together. Boom!
Garcia turned, his eyes glittering in the harsh work lights.
I don't like the feel of things, Skipper. This is a bad beginning. This is starting like a dead man mission.
Sparrow took a deep breath, exhaled slowly. With an abrupt motion, he thumbed the button of his crest mic.
Ramsey, when you contact base, request permission to return.
Aye, Skipper.
Ramsey's thoughts leaped. What will that do to morale? The first raider in months turns back without getting out of the Gulf. Bad. He stared at the wavering fingers of the dial needles. His contact timer hit the red line, buzzed. He rapped out the first pulse with its modulated message. Able John to Red Hat. Over. The speaker above his head hissed with background noise like a distant surf. Presently a voice came out of it, overriding the noise.
This is Red Hat. Over. Able John to Red Hat. We've discovered sabotage aboard. A silk rag was put in the motor system of our drive room. A static spark from the rag could have blown us out of the bay. Over.
Red Hat to Able John. Stand by, please. We are routing your message to Bird George.
Security. Again the speaker came to life.
Bird George to Able John. This is Teacher. What is the situation? Over.
Clint Reed. Ramsey could almost see the humorless face of his security teacher. Teacher Reed. Impromptu code. Ramsey bent over his own mic. Teacher, this is student. He repeated the story of the sabotage.
Teacher to student, what's your suggestion? Over.
Student to teacher. Permit us to go on with inspection out here. There's less chance for an unknown factor. Just the four of us aboard. If we check safe, allow us to continue the mission. Bad for morale if we came back. Over.
Teacher to student. That's the way we see it. But stand by.
Pause.
Permission granted. How much time do you need? Over.
Ramsey turned on his intercom microphone. Skipper, base suggests we continue the inspection here and not return if we check secure.
Did you tell them what we'd found?
Yes, sir.
What'd they say?
That there's less chance for a security slip out here, fewer personnel. They suggest we double-check each other, give every...
Suffering Jesus!
They want to know how much time we'll need.
Silence.
Skipper, they...
I heard you. Tell them we'll need 10 hours.
Ramsey turned back to his transmitter. Student to teacher. Skipper says, give us 10 hours. Over.
Teacher to student. Continue as ordered. We'll clear new checkpoints for you. Over and out.
Ramsey sat back, thought, now I've really stuck my neck out. But Obey said this one has to go through. Burnett's voice rasped over the intercom.
Ramsey, if that contact's over, get your ass up here and help me on this board.
Coming. In the drive room, Sparrow hefted a socket wrench, looked at Garcia, crouched under the secondary coils.
They want this one to go through, Joe. Very badly.
Garcia put a contact light on two leads. It glowed.
Yes. And they give us a green hand like that Ramsey. A near dryback. His service record says limited combat in Gulf security patrols. Get the priest and the parish.
He shifted to a new position.
Something odd about the chap.
Sparrow opened the plate over a condenser.
How so? He strikes me like a ringer. A chap who pretends to be one thing when he's actually something else. Where do you get that idea?
I really couldn't say, Skipper.
Sparrow shrugged, went on with his work.
I don't know, Joe. We'll go into it later. Hand me that 8-inch flex wrench, please.
Garcia reached up with the wrench, turned back to his own work. Silence came over the little room, broken only by the sound of metal on metal, buzzing of test circuits. Sparrow ducked through the door into the control room, stood silently as Bennett and Ramsey reinstalled the final cover plate of the main board. Bennett straightened, rubbed the back of his neck. His hand left a grease smear. He spoke to Ramsey.
"You're a boy, Junior. We may make a submariner out of you yet. You've just got to remember that down here you never make the same mistake once."
Ramsey racked a screwdriver in his toolkit, closed the kit, turned, saw Sparrow.
"All secure, Skipper?"
Sparrow didn't answer at once. He looked around the control room, sniffed the air. Faint smell of ozone. A distant humming of standby machinery. The round eyes of the indicator dials like symbiotic extensions of himself. The plucking disquiet remained within him.
"As secure as mortals can make it, I hope," he said. "We'll repair to the wardroom."
Sparrow turned, ducked out the way he had entered. Ramsey put his toolkit into its wall rack. Metal grated against metal. He shivered, turned. Bennett was going through the door. Ramsey stepped across the control room, ducked through the door, followed Bennett into the wardroom. Sparrow and Garcia already were there. Garcia seated to the right, Sparrow standing at the opposite end of the table. Ramsey's eyes widened. An open Bible lay on the table before Sparrow.
"We'll invoke the help of the Almighty upon our mean endeavors," said Sparrow.
Bennett slipped into a chair at the left. Sparrow indicated the seat opposite himself.
"Will you please be seated, Mr. Ramsey?"
Ramsey lowered himself into the chair, rested one hand on the green felt of the table cover. Sparrow towered above them at the other end of the table.
"The giver of the law with hand upon the book. Religious services," thought Ramsey. "Here's one of the binding forces of this crew. Participation mystique. The consecration of the warriors before the foray."
"What is your religion, Mr. Ramsey?"
asked Sparrow.
Ramsey cleared his throat.
"Protestant Episcopal." "It's not really important down here," said Sparrow. "I was merely curious. We have a saying in the Subtugs that the Lord won't permit a live atheist to dive below 1,000 feet.
Ramsey smiled. Sparrow bent over the Bible. His voice rumbled as he read,
"Woe unto them that call evil good, and good evil, that put darkness for light, and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet, and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes, and prudent in their own sight."
He closed the Bible, lifted his head. It was a movement of power, of authority. Ramsey received an impression of deep strength.
"We do our job with what we have at hand," said Sparrow. "We do what we believe to be the right thing. Though it grieve us, we do it. We do it that the godless shall perish from the earth. Amen."
Sparrow turned away, placed the Bible in a case against the bulkhead. With his back still turned to them, he said,
"Stations, everyone. Mr. Ramsey, contact base. Tell them we're ready to go. Get the time for the first checkpoint."
Ramsey got to his feet. Foremost in his thoughts was the almost physical need to examine the first telemeter record on Sparrow.
"Yes, sir,"
he said. He turned, ducked through the door to the companionway and across into his shack. Contacted base. First checkpoint in 4 hours. Ramsey relayed the information to Sparrow.
"Zero the automatic time log," said Sparrow. "Check in, everyone."
"Garcia here, drive and tow secure."
"Bennett here, main secure."
Ramsey looked at his board in the electronic shack. A queer sensation of belonging here passed over him. A sense of familiarity,
of association deeper and longer than the 5 weeks of training.
E-board secure, he said. 2 atmospheres in the hull.
He looked to the vampire gauge on his wrist. Diffusion normal plus. No nitrogen. Back came Sparrow's voice over the intercom.
Les, slide off.
Ramsey felt the sub-tug lurch, then a faint, whispering pulse of power. The deck assumed a slight upward incline, leveled. Presently it tipped down.
We're headed into the deeps, thought Ramsey, physically and mentally. From here on, it's up to me.
Mr. Ramsey, come to the control deck, Sparrow ordered.
Ramsey closed down his board, went forward. Sparrow stood, hands behind his back, feet braced slightly apart, almost precisely in the center of the control deck. He appeared framed in a background maze of pipes, wheels, levers, and dials. To his right, Garcia worked the tow controls. To his left, Burnett held the high-speed pilot wheel. The big static pressure gauge high in the control bulkhead registered 1,310 pounds, increasing. They were below 3,000 feet.
Without turning, Sparrow asked, "What's in that little box that came aboard with your effects, Mr. Ramsey?"
"Monitoring equipment for the new search system, sir."
Sparrow's head moved to follow the flickering of a tow-control dial. He turned back.
"Why was it locked?"
"It's extremely delicate and packed accordingly. They were afraid someone—"
"I'll want to see it at the first opportunity," said Sparrow.
He stepped over behind Burnett.
"Les, is that a leak in Compartment 9? "There's no moisture or pressure variant, Skipper. It has to be condensation." "Keep an eye on it."
Sparrow stepped back beside Ramsey.
"I'm going to find out quick if that disguise system in the box satisfies his curiosity," thought Ramsey. "What's your hobby?"
he asked Ramsey. Ramsey blinked.
"Astronomy."
Burnett spoke over his shoulder.
"That's a peculiar hobby for a submariner."
Before Ramsey could reply, Sparrow said,
"There's nothing wrong with astronomy for a man who goes to sea."
"The basis of navigation," said Ramsey.
Sparrow glanced sidelong at Ramsey, returned his gaze to the board.
"I was thinking as we moved out across the mooring basin back at base that we were entitled to a last look at the stars before going under the sea. They give one a sense of orientation. One night before we left Garden Glen, I was struck by the clarity of the sky. The constellation of Hercules was—"
He broke off as the ram's nose tipped upward. A down hand moved over his controls to correct for the deflection.
"Hercules," said Ramsey. "Do you mean the Kneeler?"
"Not many call him that anymore," said Sparrow. "I like to think of him up there all these centuries. Guiding mariners. The Phoenicians used to worship him, you know."
Ramsey felt a sudden wave of personal liking for Sparrow. He fought it down.
"I must remain clear-headed and objective," he told himself.
Sparrow moved to the left to get a clearer view of the pilot gauges. He studied them a moment, turned to Ramsey.
"Has it ever occurred to you, Mr. Ramsey, that these hell-diver sub-tugs are the closest thing to spaceships that mankind has developed? We're completely self-contained."
He turned back to the control board.
"And what do we do with our spaceships? We use them to hide under the liquid curtain of our planet. We use them to kill one another."
Ramsey thought, "Here's a problem. A morbid imagination, vocalized for the benefit of the crew." He said, "We use them in self-defense."
"Mankind has no defense for himself," said Sparrow.
Ramsey started to speak, stopped, thought,
"That's a Jungian concept. No man is proof against himself."
He looked at Sparrow with a new respect.
"Our underground base," said Sparrow, "it's like a womb. And the marine tunnel, A birth canal, if ever I saw one.
Ramsay thrust his hands into his pockets, clenched his fists. What is going on here? He asked himself. An idea like that should have originated with Boussyke. This man Sparrow is either teetering on the ragged edge, or he's the sanest man I've ever met. He's absolutely right about that base and the tunnel, and we've never spotted the analogy before. This bears on our problem. But how?
Sparrow said, Joe, secure the tow board on automatic. I want you to go with Mr. Ramsay now and test out the new detection gear. It should be ranged on our first checkpoint.
He looked to the big sonoran auto-nav chart on the forward bulkhead and the red dot showing their DR position.
Les, surface the Perry box and get a position reading.
Right, Skipper.
Garcia closed the final switch on his board, turned to Ramsay.
Let's go, Junior.
Ramsay looked at Sparrow, a wish to be part of this crew uppermost in his mind. He said,
My friends call me Johnny.
Sparrow spoke to Garcia.
Joe, would you also initiate Mr. Ramsay into the idiosyncrasies of our atmospheric system? The carbonic anhydrase phase regulator would be a good place to start.
Ramsay felt the rejection of his first name like a slap, stiffened, ducked through the aft door and into the companionway. Garcia followed, dogged the door behind them, turned, said,
You'd better know something about the sub-tug, Ramsay.
A new hand is always known by his last name or anything else the crew feels like calling him until after the first combat. Some guys hope they never get called by their first name.
Ramsay cursed inwardly. Security had missed that point. It made him appear like a green hand. Then he thought, But this is a natural thing, a unit compulsive action by the crew, a bit of magic. Don't use the secret name of the new man, lest the gods destroy him and his companions. In the control room, Bennett turned to Sparrow, sniffed. He rubbed a hand across the back of his neck, turned back to the control board.
He's green,
he said.
He appears willing, though, said Sparrow. We can hope for the best.
Bennett asked,
Aren't you worried about that last-minute security checkup on the guy?
Somewhat, said Sparrow.
I can't help it, said Bennett. The guy, something about him, I don't know. He strikes me as a wrong go.
Bennett's shaggy brows drew down in thought.
It could have been routine, said Sparrow. You know the going over they gave us.
I'm still going to keep an eye on him, said Bennett.
I've some paperwork, said Sparrow. Steady as she goes. Call me before the first checkpoint.
What's the watch schedule? Asked Bennett.
That's what I'm going to be working on. Said Sparrow. I want it set up so I can spend some time with Ramsay while we're still in comparatively safe waters. I don't want him goofing when the chips are down.
Sparrow ducked for the aft door, went down the companionway and into the wardroom. The first thing that struck him as he entered was the color of the wardroom table cover. A cover and a color he had seen thousands of times.
Why is it that Navy wardrooms always have green table covers? He asked himself. Is it a little of the color of the growing land? Is it to remind us of home?
In the electronic shack, Garcia and Ramsay closed down the board after testing the detection gear.
What now? Asked Ramsay. You'd better log a little sack time, said Garcia. It's Les's watch. The skipper's probably setting up the schedule right now. You may be called next. Things are pretty loose the first day or so.
Ramsay nodded, said,
I am tired.
He turned aft, said, See you later. Garcia's,
Righto,
floated after him. Ramsay hurried to his room, dogged the door, dragged out the telemeter box, unlocked it, extracted the first record strips, sat back to examine them. Pituitra and adrenaline high points showed early on the scrolls. Ramsey noted that one was before he arrived, and the other coincided with the moment pressure was first bled into the hull. The first tense moments, he thought. But that's normal. He reeled the scrolls of telemeter tape forward to the moment the sabotage was discovered, double-checked the timed setting, scanned backward and forward across the area. Nothing. But that can't be. Ramsey stared at the pattern of rivets on the bulkhead opposite him. The faint whispering of the drive seemed to grow louder. His hand on the blanket beside him felt every tuft, every thread. His nostrils sorted out the odors of the room. Paint, oil, soap, ozone, perspiration, plastic. "Is it possible for a person to go through anxiety without glandular changes?" he asked himself. "Yes, under certain pathological circumstances, none of which fits Sparrow." Ramsey remembered the sound of the captain's voice over the intercom during the period of stress, higher pitched, tense, clipped. Again, Ramsey examined the tape. Could the telemeter be wrong? He checked it. Functioning perfectly. Could there be dysfunction in the mechanism within Sparrow's flesh? Then the other fluctuations would not have registered. Ramsey leaned back, put a hand behind his head, thought through the problem. Two major possibilities suggested themselves. If Sparrow knew about the wiper rag oil spray thing, then he wouldn't be anxious. What if he planted the rag and set that Luke system petcock himself? He could have done it to disable the ship and stop the mission because he's lost his nerve, or because he's a spy. But there would have been other psychomotor indications which the telemeter would have registered. This led to the other possibility. In moments of great stress, Sparrow's automatic glandular functions are taken over by the higher cortical centers. That could tie in with the known paranoiac tendencies. There could be a systematic breakdown of normal function under stress. Such a turning away from fear that the whole being believes there could be no danger. Ramsey sat bolt upright. That would fit the pattern of Sparrow's religious attitude. An utter and complete faith would explain it. There had been religious paranoiacs before. They'd even tried to hang the label on Christ. Ramsey frowned. But of course, Schweitzer made the ones who tried to look like fools, tore their arguments to shreds. A sharp rap on Ramsey's door interrupted his thoughts. He slipped the tapes into the false bottom of the telemeter box, closed the lid, locked it. Again the rap.
"Ramsey?"
Garcia's voice.
"Yes?" "Ramsey, you'd better take a couple of anti-fatigue pills. You're scheduled for the next watch."
"Right, thanks."
Ramsey slipped the box under his desk, went to the door, opened it. The companionway was empty. He looked at Garcia's door across the companionway, stood there a moment, feeling the ship around him. A drop of moisture condensing from the overhead fell past his eyes. Abruptly, he had to fight off a sense of depression. He could almost feel the terrible pressure of water around him. "Do I know what it is to be truly afraid?" he asked himself.